Mark Krawcheck, once again, the tables have turned. I am no longer, it's not that I'm no longer a guest on your show. I am a weekly guest on your podcast, The Spoiler Room, but no, you are coming to the Kicking the Seat podcast. This is very exciting. Yeah. And it's a special occasion for the 70th anniversary of Singing in the Rain, which just came out from Warner Brothers on 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray, whatever stuff.
Multiple. All kinds.
Yes. And digital copy and all the best stuff, all the rest. So how you doing, Mark?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me on. One of my favorite musicals. It was a trivia movie a couple of years ago. So yeah.
Now you've got an extensive collection of vinyl. You do a vinyl video series. You've got a record. It's Basket Case. I'm a little disappointed that it's not Singing in the Rain sitting behind you.
Yeah. I don't actually have Singing in the Rain on vinyl yet. I know it's, well, most of the 90% of my shopping is like through thrift store and antique stores and that. And I have not run across that soundtrack. People have held on to it. I haven't looked on eBay, but those are usually scalpers and prices, and you know it's going to be pricey anyway, and then that's just going to be an eBay person, you know, scalping. So
but I mean, so let's, you're a big, you know, vinyl guy, you're also a big musical guy, is that right?
Secretly, my secret is out. Yeah, no, I do enjoy quite a number of musicals, yeah, and not every musical, but I do I watch them. If I get, you know, if it's on or something, I hear something about it or good, I'll watch them, especially some of the more classic musicals. But the modern musicals, ever since Moulin Rouge, I've gone to pretty much every single one in the theater to see. So
now, is this like a lifelong thing, or, you know, did they have to grow on you, or what? How did you come up with? Well, because I was not a musical guy until there's a story connected with Singing in the Rain. But I want to hear your story.
I eased into it. You know, as you grow up, your tastes change and evolve. You know, I did enjoy a few musicals when I was a kid, not many. 1776, I really enjoyed, but my dad used to watch that every year. That was a great musical. And was it with James K. Yankee Doodle Dandy? Mm-hmm. You know, I used to watch that as a kid every the fourth, but for the most part, musicals were just like, okay. But then as I got a little older and really got into soundtracks and that, I started catching more musicals and that. And so it kind of grew, and then it tapered off for a little bit. And then when I saw Moulin Rouge, in all honesty, it reignited that joy for musicals. And I went back and I started revisiting some, or I'd watch them whenever the wife would watch them, or, you know, I kind of actually sought them out again after Moulin Rouge. And I remember one of those things where you remember just how much you enjoy them. It's just that you have so much to watch. You sometimes forget the things you really enjoyed watching or reading, like comics or whatever, you know. It's so, yeah, that's kind of, it's ebbed and flowed. But it's been ever since the resurgence of it in the past two decades now, Jesus. You know, I've really discovered that love again for them. So
cool. Yeah. I need to go back and watch Moulin Rouge. I did not like Moulin Rouge when I first saw it, but that was because it was 2001 or 2000.
Yeah. It was 2000, early 2000s, in the aughts.
Yes. Yeah. We are so old. But that was before I really cared about musicals. I think the closest I'd come to watching one, maybe it was Finian's Rainbow when I was a kid, because my dad really liked that movie.
Sure.
But I just didn't care for them. I thought they were ridiculous. Like, oh, people are going to break out in song and like sing their feelings to each other, and it's so stupid. But it wasn't until I went to go see a Highland Park Players stage production of Singing in the Rain, because my friend was producing it, you know, at the time.
Sure.
And this is probably 15 years ago, maybe, that I went to see it. I just went because he was producing it and he was a friend. I wanted to support him and support the arts, because it's a great, you know, theater company. I had no idea what the movie was about. I'd seen the Gene Kelly bit, you know, because it's a meme. It's a pop culture staple of him singing in the rain and dancing, swirling around the light post and stuff. But I had no idea what it was about. I'm like, oh, it's some stupid love story. And I didn't know until I had sat down and the thing started that it was a musical about the movies. And I was like, wow.
Yeah.
Where have you been all my life? And I loved it. It was a local community production, but they did, you know, really well in terms of the costumes, the performances, sure. Sort of the effects and the transitions. And I didn't really appreciate what they did until I sat down last night to watch Singing in the Rain, the movie musical, for the first time.
Wow.
Yeah. You know, with my wife.
Wow. First yeah. time. Holy cow.
Yeah. And honestly, I had had a miserable day yesterday. I was tired. Sure. I was cranky. I'm like, I'm going to watch an hour and 40 minute musical starting at like 8:30 p.m. on a Friday. Come on. Within 10 minutes, I was electrified. My face was, there wasn't a mirror nearby, but I could feel myself smiling.
Yeah.
I think it was during Make 'em Laugh. Oh. I actually was like in my bed.
It was
infectious. I could not stop moving around. It was absolutely joyous. And the one thought I had in the middle of this movie is, why wasn't this the last movie ever made? Because and I know it was 1952, but for me personally, there's a part of me that says, this is the pinnacle of entertainment. This is what can be done. If you're not going to swing for these fences, take your bat and go home.
Which is interesting that they actually cover that in the extras on the disc. When someone said that this was kind of, when this came out, because this was just after American in Paris. In fact, Kelly was still doing stuff for Paris when they were making this one. It was kind of like the last, it ended up becoming a little bit more of the last hurrah of the, you know, the really upbeat, happy type of musicals. And they kind of take a turn after the mid late 50s. They start getting, you know, just different the way they're produced and everything, the musical, you know, the music numbers and everything about them. So you're right in some sense that it is looked at one of those last classic musicals, and I consider probably one of the best. It's one of my favorite all time musicals, and yeah, 104. It's like 107 minutes or something like that. You know, 103 minutes. It's like a lot of musicals are 2 hours or something, or two, you know, because you've got the log numbers, and so it comes in at a short runtime. And they're just, it's a fun, it's a happy movie. It's a, even when things don't go quite right, this is one of those musicals to where even if stuff doesn't quite go right, it's still happy.
Yeah, because it doesn't take time to the characters, when bad things happen to them, don't have an opportunity, they don't take the opportunity to wallow. Mm-hmm. They either get a bright idea like almost instantly, or there's a friend nearby who says, you know, come on, we're gonna do this together. We got pluck and vim and vinegar and spirit or whatever. But no, I agree. But seriously, this movie, for being 70 years old, and I don't know if this is just because, you know, we're living in an AI program that is not very original. Yeah. But I see this stuff playing out. You know, they've got down like the Hollywood tabloid culture. Mm-hmm. They've got the kind of the magic of movies and celebrity worship. I mean, you look at what's going on with Johnny Depp and Amber Heard. You know, they're this, you know, lovely Hollywood couple. You know, 10 years ago, they're making movies together. I think they made at least one. I think it was the Rum Diary.
Yeah, the Rum Diaries.
Right. And it's like, oh, wow, it's a Hollywood fairy tale. But then you find out it's all, you know, lies and a disaster, and they can't stand each other behind the scenes. But it's kept very closely guarded until everything falls apart and you can't really hide it because of, you know, police reports and such. But yeah, I mean, the movie stars Gene Kelly as Don Lockwood, and he's this big mega star, and he's co-starring with Lena Lamont, played by Gene Hagen, who is, they're silent film stars. This movie takes place in 1927, I think.
Yeah, it's the transition of, you know, it's that kind of popular subject for a brief moment. We talked, you know, we talked last week, you and I, about saturation and common themes. And for a little bit, Hollywood covered that transition of from talkies, you know, from silent to talkies. And this was one of them. Yeah. So it was 27, I think it takes place in, which is when most of the songs, I guess, were written for it.
For this movie?
They weren't written for this movie. The songs they used were actually written from the time period.
Right. That's what I meant. I thought that they were kind of original, like they had been written for this movie in the 50s or something.
That's what I thought it was too. I thought, well, these songs were written for this musical, but the only one written is Make 'Em Laugh.
Wow. And that, you know, that it makes more sense now. And folks, please forgive me and probably forgive Mark, although he's probably more knowledgeable on this stuff than I am. I have not watched the extra features. I've skimmed Wikipedia on this movie. I watched it for the first time last night, so I'm probably going to get a lot wrong. But it makes more sense because toward the end of the film, Lena Lamont is on stage and she prompts the orchestra to play a song. And they're like, what do you want us to play? And she says, Singing in the Rain. I was like, how would they know that? Because that's the song Gene Kelly was singing to himself in the street. But I get it now if it was a popular tune. So they've got this kind of a fake Hollywood relationship. And it's great because the movie opens with a premiere of their latest film. And there's this celebrity, you know, announcer there. They come over in these ridiculous outfits. I mean, Gene Kelly is wearing a completely white ensemble that looks like a cross between a trench coat and a bathrobe.
I want that jacket, man. Ever since I first saw it, I'm like, I want that outfit, especially that jacket.
That's where David Byrne got his entire shtick, I swear to God. He's talking about, you know, his humble beginnings, and we get this great flashback, and everything he's saying is a lie. You know, he went to the best schools. He's like getting kicked out of, you know, school, and you know, I played in these great conservatories, like playing violin badly at a bar, you know? And he gets a job as a stuntman, and he completely impresses this director, who says, "Okay, now you're my stunt guy." And so he goes and he throws himself into all these incredibly dangerous situations. Now, what amazed me and my wife, both of our jaws collapsed into our laps. There's a scene where there's some movie. I don't know what it wasn't a Western, I don't think, because they were in a car, but they drive a car off of a cliff.
Yeah.
And you see the body fall. You off see the cliff. Body. I'm like, I don't think that's a dummy. I could be wrong.
That was a stunt driver, not Gene Kelly, but it was a stunt driver. Yeah.
Right. But we're watching this, like, we know that's not the star, but that is somebody. And oh my God, I hope they're okay.
Yeah. But
that was sort of the beginning of the many marvels of this film, which is the complete mind blowing physicality of Gene Kelly and Donald O'Connor, who plays Don's sort of sidekick Cosmo. They're like kind of best friends coming up in showbiz. And also Debbie Reynolds is Kathy, who they meet later. The three of them, their physicality is amazing to watch. They look like special effects, and I don't know how they were not just like breaking bones and collapsing, especially during Make 'Em Laugh, which we'll get to.
Well, apparently, and I'm getting some of my knowledge because since I've watched the movie many times, I watched the special features in the commentary on it.
Sorry, briefly, that commentary has Baz Luhrmann on it, right?
Yeah. From
the director of Moulin Rouge.
and Debbie Reynolds. It's because they recorded that, the late Debbie Reynolds. That's actually the extra that's on this Blu-ray is from the DVD they released back in 2012, I think it was. So that's why they have Baz on there. And like the documentary has a number of Glee folks on it, as well as the director of Chicago. Chicago they're talking about, and they talk about a few other films. So it's similar to the way they did The Green Mile, in that the features actually have been released before. They're just including them on here with the remastered, looks freaking beautiful Blu-ray, Technicolor, holy wow. You know, so it's bittersweet listening to some of the people on this that are no longer with us. You know, they even have Dan O'Connor on there. He talks about Make 'Em Laugh. You know, they've got Debbie Reynolds. They have a lot of people on there that talk about it. It's interesting, but they talked about Debbie Reynolds because Gene Kelly did have a reputation a bit when it came to the choreography, that he was a stickler.
Because we talked about Xanadu,
right?
Yep. On Spoiler Room, right. And I think it was around that, because that's one of my wife's favorite movies. We don't We don't talk much about Xanadu.
Xanadu. No, no, no.
Oh my. Now you're bringing up Encanto. Come on, Mark. You want me to shut this down?
No.
I think I, in my research on that movie, I found out that he was kind of a jerk, especially when it came to being a perfectionist, which I guess I understand, but it's also unfortunate, especially because he's all like Mr. Smiles and positivity and you want to believe in him, but you're like, God, what a price.
Well, in the, you know, in the extras, they mention it. They're like, they kind of skirt around. They're very nice, but they do skirt around that, you know, he was challenging. Usually though, it was during the musical numbers that he choreographed. They said to where he was really, you know, difficult, you know, and a stickler. Otherwise he was fine. He was always in the project though. They said it was never, even in his dance routines, never about showing him specifically off. He was always creating stuff that would be comfortable for his stars. You know, and Debbie Reynolds really hadn't done anything like this before. And they used the quote a number of times, apparently said she's strong as an ox because she was a gymnast. So he, you know, I guess her feet were bleeding and, you know, at sometimes, and apparently she was going home, according to Sid Charisse, almost every night crying at first, because she's only like 18 in this. 18, yeah.
Really?
She's like 18 or 19 years old in this. Yeah, don't think about the age difference. Just don't think well, too hard.
It's not so much that. It's just that, I don't know if it was something about, you know, I was going to say older women, but women of that era, you know, they're 18. They look like they're not in a bad way, but they look like they're in their late 20s. Because
it's the way she carried herself as well in the film. She doesn't carry herself like 18 year old, but I guess she was 18 or 19 in that film. So, and this is one of her, you know, her first big lead. And so she's with Gene Kelly, and apparently they rehearsed for months and it was grueling for her, but it was one of those two. It's kind of like when you hear stories about Jim Cameron and how people say that Jim Cameron really was a difficult director, and you talk to actors and actors go, yeah, I hear he was a horrible, you know, just a difficult director. I hope to work with him one day. And you're like, what? Because and I got this impression from Gene Kelly, from the extras and the people they talked to. It's one of those where he was driven and a perfectionist, and he pushed people to be good because he could see what they could do. And he would tailor routines and stuff that would be their strength. So he helped them be really good, even if it was grueling behind the scenes. When the cameras rolled, they look on camera and they're like, holy, wow. You know, he'd get wonderful performances out of them.
And I guess that's, I understand that and I appreciate it. I guess it just depends on it. And I wasn't there, but what that kind of hard driving discipline looks like. Mm-hmm. If you're abusive and you're screaming at people, there's no need for that. But if you're, you know, like, we're going to do it again, we're going to do it again, mm-hmm. we're going to do it again, do it like this. I guess there's, then, you know, I'm not any of these people. I'm not in a 70-year-old beloved musical, but
no,
it's just, it's hard when you look at something, a film that brings so much joy, and then you hear that behind the scenes, it wasn't so pleasant. It just kind of, you know, leaves a sour taste in my mouth.
Yeah. And that's what's always interesting is you hear another story. They're like, yeah, it wasn't really, you know, it was a rough time or whatnot, but I loved doing it. You know, you hear him say, because of, like you said, what comes across on screen. You know, Gene Kelly had his own style, and there's always Fred Astaire, and they always refer to Gene Kelly as kind of more of the blue collar dancer, versus Fred Astaire, who was always the tops and tails type of, you know, guy, which he was, you know, he, so it's always interesting to see those two, and they're definitely different styles. You know, you get a ballet scene in here similar to what you got at the end of American in Paris, which apparently they threw in a little bit later. And so it said, yeah, what's that got to do with the dueling cavalier, the singing cavalier? I don't know. We don't care. You just get this wonderful extended ballet sequence in there.
Well, it's also, it's amazing because we talk about this all the time, how, and I don't mean to get on my old man screaming at the sky soapbox in my yard, telling kids to get off of my lawn. That was a horrible mixed metaphor, but
wow.
we talk about, you know, kids today, they don't want to watch anything that is older than they are. Mm-hmm. You know, if it's black and white, or if it's a 50s musical, it's going to be boring and or problematic. but and probably dull and unimaginative. That sequence towards the end that involves that ballet and also that crazy trippy painted set that looks like a backdrop, but also like there's people walking into the backdrop, so it looks physically impossible. That's all because they're trying to figure out these kind of interstitials to make this, to piece this movie together, this idea to save this doomed film. And they're pitching to the studio executive, like, what if we opened with this Broadway show? This guy's coming to Broadway. And then Gene Kelly kind of imagines it, and we get to see this 10 or 15 minute sequence or whatever. And then we come back out of it, and he's like, so what do you think? And the guy's like, I don't see it.
Yeah.
But it's just, it's the kind of weirdness and creativity and imagination that you don't expect to see in a film from 1952 necessarily. And maybe I just need to watch more films from the 50s. We also don't see it as, you know, being part of this giant big studio production, because it's almost not mainstream.
Yeah. And the term cult, and you don't think of it, but the term cult following and a cult musical is kind of what Singing in the Rain actually is. And I've heard it referenced in the behind the scenes here and some written ones as well, because again, the one you can compare it to is American in Paris. It got all the accolades. It got the awards. It got, you know, the Singing in the Rain did okay, but it didn't really get any awards. It didn't, you know, yet it was, I think, one of the first batch of films to be entered into the Library of Congress archives to be, you know, preserved. It grabbed what people would call a cult following, because even though when it came out, it didn't take off like everybody expected to, it has legs under it to where, yeah, they're releasing a 70th anniversary edition of it, you know, on Blu-ray, and it's still just as fun as the first time I watched it.
Yeah, it's strange, because it's kind of like It's a Wonderful Life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people look at that like, oh, this movie's been around forever and everybody's always loved it. No, it flopped on release. And with the case of Singing in the Rain, if Wikipedia is to be believed, because I gleaned two bits of information from Wikipedia. Mm. One is that according to them, and they would never be incorrect by anything, but it wasn't until decades later, the critical response, like a critical reevaluation of Singing in the Rain, brought people's attention back to it, got more eyes on it. And now, as you mentioned, it's on like all these top movies of all time, top musicals of all time. So yes, folks, critics do matter, or at least in case of 70-year-old musicals. But the other fact I picked up again from Wikipedia was that the profit from Singing in the Rain, the initial release, was $666,000.
Yeah, I heard about that as well. You know, and even for back then, for as big as the production was, that was considered you know, release for what it was involved in. But another thing that marks it, it's interesting because I learned it, and sorry, I keep bringing up the extras, but I did learn a lot in some of the extras, is the fact that this was one of those last films that also was one of kind of the last studio films, you know, the studio formula type of films. It was starting to change through the mid 50s, which we kind of know, to where the studio system was kind of starting to fade a little, to where you didn't have actors locked into a contract with a studio where you're only making films for us, unless we lease you out to another one, but we're going to get some major bank for it, you know. And this was kind of one of those too, because they said there was a changing of the guard at MGM as well with this musical, to where, you know, it was one of those where it was the same crew that worked on a number of musicals. I forgot who they called it, that I forgot the name of it, that they call this same group that worked on all these musicals with Gene Kelly and that. And so they kind of just were doing their own thing, apparently, with when they were making this musical, and nobody was really too focused on what they were. It wasn't like in huge in spotlight or on a lot of people's radar, apparently, when they were making this. because they were having a changing of the guard. Studio system was starting to fall apart because more people wanted to go work elsewhere rather than be locked into films, you know.
That's crazy to me, the idea that this movie could be something that could go under someone's radar, because I was thinking about this, just the amount of money they had to have spent on costumes. I mean, there are like fake or imaginary musical numbers that show up as part of montages.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, we're going to show this entire production for 10 seconds in a montage of like six, you know, flashback musical numbers that all last the same amount of time. But yet you've got the camera movements, you've got the choreography, you've got the music and the costuming and the sets. I'm like, this is insane to me.
Yeah, it is. It's interesting, but that's what they were talking about on it, is that it was, you know, it was already greenlit by a person who was in charge of green lighting a lot of musicals, and then they left MGM, but it was already greenlit before it was empty. Because in fact, I think one of the people they interviewed said, yeah, probably if that new person moved into place, this would have probably not gotten greenlit. You know, it's one of those things where the new change of the guard come in, but it already had the stamp. They already were invested, handed money aside. So,
yeah, that studio system thing is fascinating. I interviewed Michael Dante last year, who's he was sort of a player from back in that generation. I think he got in towards the end of that, but he would talk about how he got, you know, under contract at one of the studios. And in between films, they'd be like, you know, yeah, just go learn how to ride a horse or go take fencing lessons or something, because there may be a part coming up. So you kind of got paid. It was part of this being under contract. It wasn't just while you were making movies,
right,
kind of set up and being paid to be an actor who could be plugged in kind of anywhere and you know, be equipped to do anything. It was pretty fascinating.
But at the same time, they were also the pawn of the studio, in which case the studio said something, you jumped. It was right. Like you didn't really have a choice. It's not like, really, they're like, no, I don't care if you do have a kid's birthday, you're going on this press tour and you're leaving tonight.
Yeah. But you know, there is a flip side to that. I mean, because he would have, and we'll get back to Singing in the Rain in a second, but he would, there would be these mandates from the studio, like, we need you to do this publicity shoot for this, you know, teen magazine or something. And like, well, what do they want me to do? Like, they don't know. So it's like, well, but he would say, like, oh, in one specific instance, he said, well, I just moved into this house, I need to paint my house, so let me have a bunch of my actor friends come over. I think Burt Reynolds was part of that, or it was either that or the beach thing. But it's like, they would just have the photographer come over and take pictures of them, like celebrities painting this house. Like, oh, natural. Not naked, but, you know.
No. That would have really shook some trees, but no.
Literally.
Literally.
No. So I got through like a quarter of the synopsis of this movie before it got diverted, but that's okay, because that's what we do, Mark. So there's this Hollywood kind of power couple. Everything's a disaster behind the scenes. They've got a new movie coming out. After the premiere, Don Lockwood gets mobbed by a bunch of like teens in the street. He runs and he runs on top of a cable car, and then he leaps from a cable car into a car that's in motion, driven by Debbie Reynolds. Once again, this is not CGI. I imagine it's on like a sound lot, so it's, you know, kind of controlled and everything, but it's all fluid motion. There's so many just sustained shots in this film. I mean, there is some editing, of course, but what you get in these single shots is still unbelievable. So he jumps into this car, he's talking to this girl, and she's like, oh, I'm a stage actress, and he's like, oh, I'm in the pictures or whatever, and she's like, oh, that's not real acting. And so they kind of bicker, and then they never see each other again until he shows up at a party, an industry party, and she jumps out of a cake and she's all furious at him. She throws a pie, he ducks out of the way, it hits Lena, the big co-star, and that causes all sorts of problems. So later, the studio executive, was it at that same party that he introduced the talking demo?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
He puts a giant screen comes down. He starts a movie with this guy who walks from a table, gets right up close to the camera. Worst gums I think I've ever seen on a person up close. And he starts talking in this like kind of perfect diction. And everybody at the party is kind of like, okay, where's the joke? you know, mm-hmm. there's someone behind the screen like talking, because it's impossible to sync up, you know, sound
with film. Yeah.
With film. So the big studio executive RF is like, nope, this is a new thing. Warner Brothers is coming out with this movie called The Jazz Singer. It's probably a fad. Jazz Singer comes out, blows everything out of the water. All of a sudden the talk of Tinseltown is the talkies. And so this studio head says, okay, we need to get Lockwood and Lena. What was her
name? Lena. Yeah.
Yeah. Lena Lamont, Lockwood and Lamont into a talking picture. The problem is Lena has the most grating, annoying voice and terrible personality I may have seen in any movie ever.
Beautiful. It's beautiful. And what's funny is who was playing her, I forgot offhand,
Jean Hagen
was a known actress at that time. You know, I mean, she was a known name at that time. She had done a number of musicals. She's got the most grating voice. She just plays it up so well, just what you needed with this character too.
Because I think they kind of, it's sort of a reveal, because you notice mm-hmm. in all the publicity stuff, it's always Don Lockwood talking, and yeah. you kind of get this feeling that it's, you know, kind of overt, like male chauvinist movie star, like kind of butting in, you know, to take right. all the spotlight. But you realize it's a strategy, because they're silent movies, so no one actually knows what she sounds like.
Yeah.
And it's probably for the best, because she needs to retain her fan base. But when these talkies come out, they do the Dueling Cavalier. It's sort of this period drama starring the two of them, and it's got to be a talkie, so they're wiring her for sound. It's a disaster. They figure everybody's career is over, until Debbie Reynolds' character Kathy shows up, and there's this bright idea of like, well, we'll have her sing Lena's parts, and we won't tell Lena, because Lena hates Kathy.
So already you see them talking about talkies and talking about doing ADR already. Look at it. It's like I'm watching you watch this again, and I'm just picking up. I'm like, oh, look, they're talking about ADR. Oh, they're talking about it's like.
Well, it's kind of charming, because now everyone's got like, you know, booms and lav mics and stuff. But back then, well, according to the reality of this picture, they're right. taking a giant microphone and trying to hide it in a bush. But, you know, whenever she delivers her dialogue, her head's moving from here to here. So it's picking up like every other word. She's like, okay, we'll put it in your bustier. Oh, that's not good enough. We'll put it in this like giant flowery lapel yeah. thing. And still that's not working. And then, of course, the opening night comes, the preview. It's not exactly a premiere. It's the preview right. to see what people are going to make of it. And the sound is terrible. She sounds horrendous. The sound gets out of sync. And so there's like this crazy delay. And then the sound like kind of eats itself. So she's like, oh, my goodness. It's like it reminded me of Ed Wood.
Yeah, it did. It did. It was it's about as worse as you could have a pre-screening go for their talkie, which is also interesting. Again, the film doesn't get heavy, and it doesn't get too dark or emotional or brooding, but it touches on a number of things that you see. It affects your main characters. We just don't stay on it that long. Like, you know, it is addressing the idea that did happen during the transition of silent to talkies. Some actors made the great transition. Some of them didn't. Some of them who were huge names, they had accents. They barely talked English. They didn't talk English at all in their silent picture. They didn't have to. But now when they had to talk, totally changed people's perspective. And you've got that here where they address it. And it's in this short scene. They address the topic. And they move on. You know, Lamont, Lockwood, he's like holding his face up. He's trying to hide, you know, and they're saying this is the worst Lamont Lockwood film ever made. And they're like, oh, man. And then that's where the three of them get together, Debbie Reynolds and, you know, the two guys, they get together. And that's where you get Good Morning, which I still quote that song every so often.
But it's just, yeah, it's this idea that sort of the innovation, you know, mm-hmm. kind of the all hope is lost until it's not. And if you've got, it's a cheesy kind of a trite sentiment, but it's also true. If you've got, you know, a strong enough support system and you're creative and you believe in each other, you can find your way out of just about anything. And they do. They come up with this wacky idea to not only have her sing the parts, but to make the movie contemporary. So it's not just this, you know, period drama. It's kind of a ridiculous comedic premise. They're going to make it about a modern Broadway performer who gets hit on the head with a sandbag, and all of a sudden he thinks he's back in A Tale of Two Cities or whatever the hell it is. But it's still fun, and they pull it off, and everyone's dreams come true.
It even has a happy ending.
Except for Lena Lamont.
Except for Lena. Lena doesn't exactly have a happy ending. No, you do feel bad for her. You realize later on at the end of the film just how cruel our characters were kind of to her in public.
But it's interesting because I was actually thinking about that too, especially the idea of, could I recommend this to someone who's 20 years old? Mm-hmm. Especially someone who's been brought up in the era of Me Too and, you know, inequities between the sexes and all of this stuff, you know, that's in the culture. And that the alarm started going off in that scene where, okay, they have the premiere of the new movie, right?
Right.
And then everyone kind of comes out on stage, and then Lena decides she wants to go out and say a few words because the guys are kind of getting some ideas about the contract. I got to rewind a bit. She gets the idea that to go to the press and say that she's going to be doing a whole bunch of, you know, more movies, musicals, yeah, right? Because she was such a smashing success. But she's going to have Kathy do the vocals,
right,
kind of behind the scenes. So Kathy's never going to have a career because she's going to be the vocal silent partner.
Right. She's not going to get credited either.
Right. And Kathy's locked into a contract with a studio. Lena's got tremendous pull at the studio. She's got the exec wrapped around her finger. So she's kind of screwing everybody because they screwed her because she's nasty. It's like this giant, like, never ending circle of violence.
Hollywood. No, just kidding.
No, probably not far off. But she decides to go out and, you know, address the audience, and everyone hears her squeaky, terrible, poorly dictioned voice. Then she decides to sing. She sings Singing in the Rain. Don and Cosmo get this idea, and they conspire with the studio exec to lift the curtain separating Kathy, who's singing for real behind the curtain, and Lena in the front, to expose the entire fraud, thus sink Lena's star power immediately to kind of like make her the poison pill or whatever. In that moment, I thought, yeah, here's these three powerful guys conspiring gleefully to humiliate this woman. And it did kind of rub me the wrong way until I'm like, well, it shouldn't, though, because she was exhibiting the same like nasty, underhanded, manipulative behaviors that a male character could have in that situation, right, and probably has in other movies. So I'm like, if I do have, you know, fairness on my mind, I have to say, well, she got what she deserved.
No, she did. You know, she did. I think it's just the fact that you have the three guys pulling the curtain up that, you know, for our, you know, our 2022 mentality, we're like, oh, that's great. But, you know, at the same time, you're like, well, she kind of, you know, she was horrible to Kathy. She, you know, not realizing what Kathy was actually doing for her. Not appreciating, I should say. She knew what she was doing. She's not appreciating it. Had the privilege thing going on. So yeah, at first that was like the only scene too. But yeah, I had thought about it. I'm like, well, no, she was pretty much a dick. You know, she to Kathy and Ed and using her privilege and star power to pull a lot of things. You know, spend money and just do all these wild kind of diva things. So yeah, she, you know. Could they have got about it a better way? Sure. But then, you know, it was just the way it played out. They, you know, the ultimate, like, get the idea across that, yeah, she's done. She's done, which she might not either, though. You know, it's one of those things with that. She still had the name. She probably still had fans afterwards. But, sure, you know, and then what I find interesting, too, is you think about it for a moment, you go, oh, well, they come up with this idea for Kathy being the voice, and oh, Lockwood put, I'm like, actually, Lockwood says no, he didn't want to do it, and Kathy volunteered for the good of the picture. That's which right. I thought was an interesting little twist, is the way they played it, because here, you know, they're like, hey, this is great, and he's like, no, because he knew, being the veteran actor, he knew you're not going to get credit for this, you know, doing, he's like, you're not doing this, we can't tell you what you, and yet she still wanted to do it for him. You know, I mean, it's still 50s mentality, folks. So, but she was doing it because it was his career as well in this film. And if Lena goes down, Lockwood's going to go down as well in a horrible musical.
Well, I mean, you say the 50s mentality thing, and I understand where you're getting at, but
yeah,
it's not just the woman kind of sacrificing for the guy's career, because as you mentioned, he was willing to, you know, to tank things.
Right.
For the love of Kathy. So, and on top of that, people sacrifice in relationships. Mm-hmm. I understand the cliche of, like, you know, the guy's the breadwinner and the little lady back at home and's got to, you know, support and everything. And there is, you know, there are problems with that, but, you know, in strong relationships, there is devotion and sacrifice. And sometimes that involves a man and woman, strangely enough. I did like the kind of the growth that Kathy undergoes. And I see she evolves as a character in this movie, because as we established, when they first meet, she doesn't give a crap about movies. She's like, he's like, have you seen my pictures? Cause apparently he does, like, you know, 18 movies a year or something like that. And she's like, yeah, I think I might've seen one once. She couldn't care less, but later on, she gets a job, you know, because he spots her again as,
right.
as a dancer on this, you know, this film set. And you yep. kind of get the idea that she's getting to experience Hollywood, and she kind of likes what she sees. She likes these opportunities and, you know, some of the people that she's meeting. So she does develop this a love for an art form that she had kind of dismissed. And then she has her heart broken by this kind of the horrible situations that can happen in Hollywood, but the love is sort of redeemed at the end when we see them kissing in front of a giant billboard for Singing in the Rain.
Singing in the Rain,
the movie musical. You don't get, you know, meta humor and meta context is not something from the 2000s. They were doing this
it's
52 at least.
It's quite popular. The Backstage Musical, which is a musical about a musical, which, you know, you think about it, is the easiest setting to explain why people would suddenly bust out into song. So that's why there are a lot of these, you know. Moulin Rouge was still like that. It was the, you know, Backstage Musical where they're putting on a musical. So it makes sense. These people are singing. And that's been around for ages where they, you know, the forget, you know, White Christmas as well. I mean, all these musicals, a lot of them were self-referential. They're making the musical that you're watching the musical. Yeah.
I watched White Christmas for the first time, I think 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. I love that movie. Again, that's one of the nice things about getting older and not having watched a lot of these kind of seminal movies when I was younger, is I feel like I'm in an age where I can really appreciate them the first time. I feel like if I'd watched this when I was 12 or something, I'd be like, oh, I don't want to watch that movie again. It's stupid. But, you know, one thing I thought about as well watching this movie, because of the theme of, as you mentioned, a very popular theme of the silent to the talkie era. Did you see The Artist back in 2011?
The Artist?
Yeah.
No, I did not. That was the silent one they did, right?
Yeah. That was about the same. It wasn't a musical, right. But it was about a silent film star making the transition to talking pictures.
Right.
And I loved that movie. It's gotten a lot of backlash because it was artsy and black and white and, you know, kind of, I guess, self-indulgent, but I thought it was a really kind of beautiful, you know, art piece. I would recommend checking that movie out. We kind of skipped past it, but I did mention it, was Make 'Em Laugh.
Yes.
Where Cosmo is, I can set that scene up for me, because I remember the scene, the sequence, but I don't remember what caused it. Why did he start singing to?
He was Don giving, Lockwood? Well, because he was making a suggestion to Don Lockwood, you know, what they should do, because the talkie was coming out and that, and they were talking about the next picture, what they should do, and, you know, and how he should go about it. And he said, maybe they should make it a comedy. And he was talking about his approach to things, because these two guys came up through vaudeville. So they were kind of reminiscing as well, if I remember correctly, about their, you know, vaudevillian, and maybe we could go back to vaudeville. I think he said it was one of the things. And, you know, he's like, no. He's like, you know, he goes into the make them laugh song, which, yes, folks, it is intentional that it is very similar to Be a Clown. There's a song, Be a Clown, out there that from The Pirate, I think it is, or whatnot. But it is pretty much beat for beat that, but it's different words in that. But they did that on purpose because it was a recognizable song. But they needed a song for him. And yeah, it's a phenomenal comedic piece that just shows off Donald O'Connor's abilities. Like, wow.
The way he throws himself around, and, you know, he's dancing, but he's also doing a lot of physical humor. He reminded me of a couple weeks ago. I was just like scrolling YouTube, and someone put up one of Jim Carrey's first stand-up performances.
Sure.
And he does this bit. I'd seen him do it a few times. I never really pay attention to it, but he kind of like turns to the side and then collapses his body almost at a 90 degree angle and falls on the floor. And you're like, how do you do that? How do you accomplish that and still pop right back up and tell jokes? You know, O'Connor's dancing and flipping around and throwing himself over couches and springing back up and then dancing on chairs or whatever he's doing. It boggles the mind.
And apparently, listening to the commentary, apparently a number of those sequences were just made up on the fly.
No.
Pretty much on the fly, like they came up with them that day, because he shot for one day, and apparently the only reason he had to come back and shoot part of it again was there was a problem with lighting or the film or something. Otherwise they shot that whole sequence in like one day. They just put it together and said, okay, what are we going to do, you know? And like, I guess the bit with the dummy on the couch,
yeah,
they just saw that dummy as a prop that was sitting in the corner, and they said, I guess the one guy said, the director said, here, see what you can do with this, and they filmed it, and they kept it in the film. That was just him playing around with it. That was just not even really, you know, he was just seeing what he could do with it, and they filmed it while he was doing it, and they kept it in the movie. And apparently he had never done the flip before either. That was the first time he's actually done the wall flip. He did it twice.
Yeah, I still can't quite fathom that double,
yeah,
know, running up the wall and
running up the wall and flipping. Yeah, it's a wonderful, fun sequence that, you know, it fits the movie too. That's the one thing that if you want a masterclass in how to have a film flow like water, like transition from one to the other, I mean, this movie just moves. It is just constantly, even in slower parts, it is constantly moving. You know, it's flowing from one scene to the other that felt natural. None of it felt like, oh, you know.
Well, it's got a strange, almost a bait and switch quality to it, because there's not a whole lot of music in the first two acts compared to act three, when it's like almost all music all the time. And I had forgotten parts of the stage production. So I was like, is this one of those movies where it's a musical, but only because they're making a musical, and the only time you really hear music is when they're doing the musical sequences?
And La La Land. Sorry.
No, that's fair point. Listen, I know we're not going to relitigate La La Land.
I know.
The best film of that year.
I know.
But it's not. I mean, there's a little bit of that in the earlier part of the film, but then the characters are singing to each other. They're singing to themselves. And then we get these full on musical numbers. It almost became a bit too much for me. And that might be because it was like 10 o'clock at night. By the time I got to act three, I'm like, Oh God. Wait, 15 minutes. That's how long we're going to be doing this same number or whatever it is. But it's all great. I know I can go back and rewatch this. I want to go back and rewatch this because the film made me so happy. It made me happy in my soul. I'm
it
like,
does.
Hollywood has lost something. And I understand that grim and gritty and realistic and stuff is kind of the name of the game nowadays, but can we return to positive, upbeat, dare I say, inspirational, big budget filmmaking?
You know, when it's not a biopic or something, you know, just a regular old, you know, I don't know if your modern audience has maybe become too cynical, but for me, yeah, this is one of those just happy films. It's like you watch it at the end and you feel good. It puts you in a good mood. You can't help it because Gene Kelly's got his smile. Even like I said, when people are down, they're not. And if they are, it's not long before somebody either cracks a joke or moves on, or they fade out to another scene and they're already starting something fun. Apparently there was supposed to be more one or two more musical numbers in the beginning, but they cut them. A couple songs that ended up later on being sung a little bit. I forgot which one it was, but there was supposed to be a number to where Gene Kelly sings like in a robe or whatnot at home after he meets Catherine again.
In his trench coat.
So there was supposed to be more, but I think they cut it with, you know, time in that. But yeah, it's hard to say. You know, you show a film like this and some people might be a little cynical, or that's too cheesy or campy. I'm like, there's nothing wrong with a little bit of cheese or even a positive film if it's told well, and this one is told excellently. You know, I even bring it up. It's going to sound a weird transition, but stay with me. The horror movie, the World War II horror movie Overlord. Okay.
Mm-hmm. I haven't seen it, but I've heard.
Okay.
It,
yeah. The horror movie Overlord. It's the closest thing we will ever get to an accurate Wolfenstein 3D movie, live action. Bar none, closest thing we're ever going to get to a live action. And it's got zombies and everything taking place during World War II. And the first act of it is mostly like a war picture. The middle chunk is all the zombies and mutants and all that fun stuff. But a little bit of spoiler, it actually ends on a happy note, which blew my mind. I did not expect it to end like that. And I loved it. And that's the problem, though, is we're in an age now to where if you get a film that ends on a truly legitimately happy note, it's looked at as, it's looked at kind of weird. Like,
come on, man, life's not happy. I don't want to see this. This is make-believe fairy tale bullshit. But no, I get the kind of cheese angle too. It's a criticism I see of a lot of older films. And what I think the problem is they weren't conceived to be cheesy. It's just that there was certain styles of acting as film has evolved from more theatrical, because, you know, film began its roots in theater, in stage, right, where people would have to project and be a little bit more theatrical, to kind of play right to the back of the house, as they used to say. And then over time, different styles evolved and you've got people acting more naturally on film. It's not that the people, you know, in Singing in the Rain are unnatural. They're not even that theatrical. It's just a little bit more upbeat and performative than real, I think, in a lot of cases.
Well, and you just had triple threats in here. Debbie Reynolds, Donald O'Connor, excuse me, and Gene Kelly, they're the triple threats. They were actors, singers, and dancers. You know, you had to be back then for stuff like this, or in general, because most of them did come from stage. So yeah, the more expressive in their faces, more projecting, more animated because, you know, used to stage. So yeah, you make a good point about their style, and it comes up in their documentary that says, you know, Singing in the Rain for a New Generation. They're interviewing dancers and choreographers. They even have Usher on there, who did a 2007 reenactment of Singing in the Rain. He's actually a big fan on here. And Paula Abdul, they interview her as well on here, because she became a big she was a big fan of Gene Kelly and became really good friends with him in the last years of his life. But
I can imagine that. You know, Paula Abdul is amazing back in the day.
Yeah. And they talk about, they asked the choreographers, and it's like, Yeah, the way they shoot back then, because you mentioned it earlier, the long shots in that they do, the single takes, the few edits they do during these dance routines, they're like, you couldn't do that nowadays. He goes, those folks trained for months. He's like, you'd have your talent winded nowadays too much trying to do that. I mean, that routine, the where they're doing the dialect coach routine, where Donald O'Connor and you know, Gene Kelly are just dancing the, they're just holy.
Well, but even before they start moving around, just the, because the, yeah, they've got the dialect coach who's trying to teach Don Lockwood how to do a convincing like period accent.
Yeah.
And he's got one of those kind of diction books where they're kind of like rolling their R's and they got these tongue twisters and stuff. But they start off with a simple tongue twister and then a little more complicated one. And then O'Connor breaks in and he's playing off of Lockwood and then the dialect coach. Just the linguistic dancing alone, I couldn't figure out how do you do this without 900 takes to get it right.
And then they're dancing and everything. But yeah, and it's long takes. These, you know, because we're talking film, folks. They're shooting film back then. So you try to get as best take you can the first time because film costs money. And
well, also in that same scene, in the actual dancing, there's a bit where the dialect coach is sitting on a chair in the back of the stage. Mm-hmm. And Kelly and O'Connor, they dance. They go to the back of the room. I think they jump up on some chairs. They're dancing across the chairs horizontally and swinging their arms, and then they jump off, almost knocking into the guy sitting in the chair, but he doesn't flinch.
No.
And I'm thinking, like, okay, I would be very tense, but also just Kelly and O'Connor, like the way that they're swinging their arms and dancing horizontally to the side and not touching each other, it's almost like got these force fields, almost like CGI cutouts. Like, mm-hmm. The only way we could do this is to composite them next to each other, because again, like so much in this film, it looks physically impossible.
Yeah, it does. And that's from the months and months of rehearsal they actually did beforehand, where all three of them are dancing or two of them are dancing. I mean, the sequence we talk about for Good Morning is another one where you look how they're in sync so well. It's three people, no less. Usually two is hard enough, but you have three people dancing and they're in sync so much with their, you know, it's like they're not even thinking about the moves anymore. They've practiced so much. The moves are second nature. They know what everybody's going to be doing.
There's a great use of 3D space. I mean, they're using these entire sets going from foreground to background and looping around, and you know, it's bonkers. And it's just beautiful to watch. And it, again, I keep going back to this, like, what are movies doing nowadays? I mean, CGI is impressive and you can do a lot of cool things, and that's not to denigrate anybody, mm-hmm. but I'm watching this that was filmed practically and it's full of imagination and just genuine. I have not been this amazed by anything I've seen in the last 20 years with a $1 billion budget as I am this musical that didn't do very well 70 years ago.
Right. And that was what makes it a classic. It's one of those things where you look at it, you go, how? But you know, the time it came out, it was in some ways a little bit ahead of its time as far as its concept and everything and what was going on with it versus what people expected from your cinema at the time. So you know, it just same reason why American in Paris, you know, this wild long ballet, you know, interpretive dance type scene that you get, which you get in here in City of the Rain. It's like, that was newer stuff. That was really, you know, progressive stuff for back then. And it kind of took people back a bit. If you weren't a cinema person, your average audience, you're like, what is this? What are you doing?
Well, one last thing I want to bring up, because you mentioned Debbie Reynolds. I can't believe she was 18 when she made this, but you know, was this like her breakout role?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, she, according to everything that I was reading up on and what they talk about on the disc, is this was her first. She had done some roles, but this was her first leading role that she had. And after this, it really broke her out, and it really was a breakout role for her.
Because it reminded me of her daughter, Carrie Fisher. Mm-hmm. you know, 20 some years later, broke out at 19 in Star Wars.
Right. It's kind of weird. Yeah. But yeah, this was, I believe, her first starring role. She hadn't really done any musicals. She hadn't done any singing really in her other shows. And yeah, she, you know, with the help of Gene Kelly making her cry every night, not that he was intentionally, no, but just right. the physicality of it and the doubt that she could do it because it was so difficult. You know, she took off from there. And it's a film that it's why I love cult films and maybe a little lesser known films, because you end up getting like this to where they're still being talked about 70 years later. You know, it's a film that it's referenced everywhere. The Singing in the Rain, there's so many sequences besides just Gene Kelly dancing in the rain, which, don't get me wrong, is phenomenal. One thing Kelly always could do in his dancing, whatever he was dancing, is he looked like he was having fun. It looked seamless and he was always smiling. Fred Astaire, no offense to Fred Astaire, but he wasn't always smiling. He always kind of had that more classy, like, I'm out here and look at me, I am Fred Astaire and I got, you know, I'm dancing. And don't get me wrong, love Fred Astaire movies too, and he did smile, but Kelly's always smiling in anything he's dancing.
It's something I noticed, and maybe it's because the only other Gene Kelly frame of reference I have mm-hmm. is unfortunately Xanadu, and he was much older at this point, so he had, you know, kind of the more aged face.
Yeah, yeah.
But in this movie, this might just be the high def transfer or something, but he's got like a smile crease that almost looks mm-hmm. like he's got a cut in his face, but right? I just realized that's just where his mouth arches up because he's smiling so damn much.
He's always smiling. He's got his head tilted back a little bit. And in a lot of his dance scenes where he's dancing with someone, he's not always up front, you yeah. know? I mean, he's got a style to him. There's a reason why people talk about him, and it, just a talent. And you don't get a lot of talents like that on screen, you know, doing that. And it comes across and it's infectious. It really is. His mood and everything, you're just like, and it's a guy, you know, someone made a point on one of the documentaries, they're like, when they watched him, I think it was Usher, he was like, he was watching a guy doing this dancing, you know, in a kind of masculine way, but still, here's a guy dancing, not like your normal dance. I mean, he's doing ballet type stuff and fluid stuff in film on screen. And it's like, wow, you know, maybe not quite so masculine moves, but he's doing a full dance routine, which is usually, at least back then, for sure, equated to, you know, more of a female role, or you would see, or something along that line. So
that's very interesting, because I didn't really think about that until you brought it up just now. But there is a very masculine quality to the guys who are dancing in this mm-hmm. movie. So if anyone were ever to come to me and say, oh, dancing is just for chicks, I mean, we don't live in the 1950s. So I don't think I wouldn't encounter something like that necessarily. But like, okay, go watch Singing in the Rain. And you tell me that Gene Kelly right. and Donald O'Connor are not the baddest motherfuckers you've ever seen. Like, well, on a yeah. stage.
Well, exactly that. Because I mean, yeah, you did have guys dancing in musicals. I'm not saying you didn't, but you look at the way they danced versus especially what Gene Kelly started putting to film, in the way a guy was dancing and the choreography stuff that he put in, that stuff was new back then. Usually the guys were waltzing and sidestepping and doing more traditional kind of ballroom type dancing. Even Fred Astaire, as wonderful, fantastic as he is, a lot of his style was more classical style. Whereas, you know, Gene Kelly's was more new avant-garde, new artistic approach to it. You know,
I mean, Donald O'Connor alone, I feel like if you got in a brawl with him, he would just turn his body into a human tornado, like a human Tasmanian devil, and just wipe the floor with you while smiling.
While smiling. They yes. would be smiling.
He was absolutely. The discovery for me. What has he been in other? Have you seen him in other musicals?
I'm trying to remember. I've seen him in other films. I can't recall offhand. But yeah,
he's wonderful.
Yeah.
Just so
he
funny.
He was a comedic line, talent.
Yeah. Well, there was the line when they rediscover Kathy, you know, in that production mm-hmm. and Cosmo's like, you know, Don is so happy. We're so happy we found you. Don's been looking in cakes all in every cake in town. Or looking inside every cake
every
in town.
Cake in town.
Just these little zippy asides. He's the classic, you know, sidekick character, but he has, you know, he's so funny. All right. Well, do you have any closing thoughts on Singing in the Rain?
It's a classic. I mean, even though folks maybe not want to double dip or whatnot, if you were thinking about it, get it. It looks beautiful. You know, the whole Technicolor angle, it's got colors that pop. It, you know, they really play to its strength. It's just a fun movie. It is a fun movie that isn't 2 hours long for a musical, which is unusual. And there's just so much fun to be had here. So much entertainment. And it doesn't get too heavy. And it's one of those films where I think if you watch it and just put your modern kind of sensibilities aside and just appreciate the film, there's so much to love in this movie. And it's a happy film. You need a happy, uplifting movie. Singing in the Rain is one of those. Even at its lowest point, it's not low at all. Yeah, it's fun.
It is celluloid comfort food.
It is. It's exactly what it is. Yeah.
Having watched it for the first time last night, really the film version, I feel like this is something I'm going to go back to whenever I need a pick me up. But all right. Well, yeah. Thanks, Mark, for joining. Yeah, I'm going to give you the license to show beyond. I'm going to show for you, but you've got, you know, we're talking about this, this Warner Brothers release, which is ironic because Warner Brothers was mentioned as the rival studio that was releasing The Jazz Singer.
Right.
And now Warner Brothers is releasing an MGM movie. Because everyone's buying each other, but no, you're doing an unboxing of this that'll be out this week.
I do a little special version of the final cut now called Discovery. You know, because we got to do puns. That's just a thing. So that's what I'm doing, and I'll be where I get up close and personal, just with some of the artwork. We look at some of the features, the inside of it, and I give kind of my thoughts on the extras and all of that. So, those have been fun. They've been interesting. So I'll be posting that this week for sure. It'll probably be up when we're recording this tomorrow. Hopefully, I can get to it. I've got that going on, specialmarkproductions.com for pretty much everything else. You want links to everything that I do, including 1 minute reviews, which people seem to really dig.
You're the TikTok king.
TikTok something. But, I've got, I already got a review up there of The Unbearable Weight of Talent, Nick Cage film. And I've also got, you know, Everything Everywhere All at Once. You know, my wife gives me the weird eye as I'm trying to rehearse them because I usually don't write my reviews down, but for those I have to, and I time myself and then I try multiple takes and she can hear me through the floor and she's just like, why don't you just go longer? And I'm like, no, I've got to hold it to a minute.
That's the thing about TikTok videos. If you want to do the 1 minute thing, you could spend an hour trying to get 1 minute just right.
folks, all those wonderful, beautiful people that do the wonderful tight dance routines, they were rehearsing it nearly as long as the cast was rehearsing their dance routines and Singing in the Rain, I can guarantee it. So there you go. How you like that segue, huh? Oh,
I don't, because you're comparing TikTok dancers to the artists that were in Singing in the Rain. All
it's for the kids.
TikTok dancers. No, all right, cool. And also, spoiler room, we're doing that every Tuesday night.
We do the spoiler room every Tuesday night. We're finishing up Slaying It month with Buffy the Vampire Slayer. We're closing it out. And I've got an interview coming up with indie filmmaker Tony Wash. Hopefully it's scheduled. We can hope going to try to make that happen. And next month is going to be the night of's month.
I can't wait. I saw that lineup and I'm jazzed.
Yeah, it's an exciting lineup. So we do a lot of crazy stuff like that. And also just one more plug is, again, if you're a horror filmmaker out there looking to submit to film festivals, there's a Sawdust City Fright Fest. It's on Film Freeway. They're taking submissions for at least beginning of June, the 1st of June. They're still open till the 1st of June. So you got a full month to submit your film. Real cheap submission fee, and it gets to be seen by people if it's picked who appreciate indie films in the second weekend of October. So there you have it.
And I'll have links to all of that stuff down below. So definitely check it out. Support Mark. Mark, thank you so much for talking Singing in the Rain. I guess I should mention that it's available as of the time you're seeing this now on 4K Ultra HD from Warner Brothers Home Video, wherever you buy your stuff.
Digital and disc.
Yes. So. Now, this isn't like a paid promotion or anything, but yeah, we did get review copies from the studio because we're highfalutin critics and all that. So go check it out. And if you don't like it, then, well, we're not going to reimburse you. You got to take a chance. But anyway, I am always Ian Simmons of Kicking the Seats. Please like and subscribe to the channel. Like and subscribe and support Mark and all of his endeavors. Thank you very much. And until next time, whenever that is, whatever that is, thanks and take care.